This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here with us here on WNRN and the Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm Rick Moore. A program today that caught my attention, I don't know, a couple months ago when I saw the title of this book. John, Dr. Portman, title of the book?
The Ethics of Sex and Alzheimer's.
Now, how does that not get you going and all fired up for a good discussion? Our guest today, Dr. John Portman, he's from UVA's Professor of Religious Studies. Let's see, Dr. Portman's studies include moral history, psychology, Roman Catholic theology, sexual ethics. Some of the books include The Ethics of Sex and Alzheimer's, In Defense of Sin, and When Bad Things Happen to Other People. We could certainly, that last topic could get my attention for quite some time, when bad things happen to other people. Give me a couple sentences on what we could talk about for an hour with that.
That book is about the German word Schadenfreude, and this is an emotion that people have feared and have hesitated to discuss. Many people deny that they feel great when other people fail and suffer, but in point of fact, we often do when we see a political opponent fail, when we see a murderer or a rapist go off to prison, we jump and scream, and there's a lot to be said about that. There's something to be said as well about seeing one of your rivals, someone you think is a bad person, get hurt, suffer something pretty minor, and end up humiliated in a public way. And so that's a book investigating the morality of feeling good when other people suffer.
So I'm going to invite you on to talk about that
okay.
in the future as well. I find that fascinating and somewhat troubling to
it is troubling.
To admit
the dark underside of the human mind, exactly.
Our Darth Vader thoughts on other people's problems. But today, Dr. Portman here, morals, ethics, sex, and Alzheimer's. I thought that those four words should certainly catch the attention of a large number of listeners here on WNRN, with a lot of focus here on the newest book released in paperback, The Ethics of Sex and Alzheimer's. Again, Dr. John Portman, UVA professor from Religious Studies. Professor Portman, you mentioned early on in the book that Alzheimer's punishes not only its victims, but also those married to them. Now, we've talked about this in the past, discussing Alzheimer's here, about how it hurts the caregiver, more of in a sense of being tired and watching the emotional strain on the relationship from more of physical standpoints or emotions in terms of watching those you love suffer. But that's not exactly dead on how you're speaking of this.
No, we hear frequently in America, where our incarceration rate is extremely high, that when a man goes to prison, his wife and children go with him. Because the family structure suffers when the father is absent, it makes sense to talk about the wife and the children being in some sense in prison with their father or their husband. Now, obviously, in a literal sense, no. The wife and the children still live at home, and they can come and go as they please. They're free, but they are pinned down in a way that really deserves our thought and perhaps our sympathy. And I think the same is true for many diseases, but particularly with regard to Alzheimer's, for a couple of reasons, which I'm happy to explain. I myself became personally interested in Alzheimer's in 1999 when John Bailey published his very moving book, Elegy for Iris. As a college student and as a graduate student, I had read the work of Iris Murdoch. She's an influential philosopher. She's English. She's also a prolific novelist. And she very suddenly succumbed to Alzheimer's in a way that was then brought to life in a major motion picture starring Judi Dench as Iris Murdoch. And John Bailey, an English professor at Oxford University himself, a renowned scholar, wrote this very moving testimonial to what it felt like to be married to someone who succumbs to Alzheimer's. We know that unlike cancer, which tends to take its victims fairly quickly, within a couple of years, Alzheimer's can stretch on for decades. And we know that there are more and more people who beat cancer, who live beyond it. But we know that, unfortunately, there is no cure for Alzheimer's. And as you progress through the stages of Alzheimer's, life gets more and more frightening. A person you love, a person you've honored, drifts away from you and no longer knows who you are anymore. And I found the book quite moving, in part because I didn't know how I myself would respond to such a situation. Okay, so that was a major release in 1999, and then if I may continue, fast forward, in 2005, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, arguably the most powerful woman in the United States, shocked the nation by announcing that she was going to retire from the Supreme Court. She had been appointed in 1981. She was still healthy and going strong. And she told us that she would be leaving within a year or so in order to return to Phoenix to care for her husband, who had succumbed to Alzheimer's. So this was a very, very newsworthy event. Everyone became aware. We all knew about Alzheimer's. It is an epidemic. But this was an example of an even more high-profile person than Iris Murdoch, bringing the social and familial sort of implications of this disease to our attention. So Justice O'Connor left the court, went back to Phoenix, and then in late 2007, something truly remarkable happened. Justice O'Connor's son, Jay, gave an interview to a local television station in Phoenix. And in that interview, he revealed that his father had fallen in love again. So it seems that Justice O'Connor would go to this Alzheimer's ward every day to visit her husband, who no longer recognized her. He seemed to think of her just as sort of a nice lady who showed up with cookies and cared for him. And so what Mr. O'Connor started to do, apparently, was to ask Justice O'Connor for advice on how to court his new girlfriend. And this news broke my heart. And Justice O'Connor's son revealed that far from condemning her husband, she blessed the romance because she said it made him happy. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, we hear such a lot about gays and lesbians changing the sexual ethic of America. This is something truly revolutionary. And so I thought and thought and thought about Justice O'Connor and what it would be like to walk in her shoes. She's a notoriously private individual, so we didn't know what she was going through. She would not discuss it openly. But I wondered, is this adultery? We don't know whether Mr. O'Connor had a sexual relationship with his new girlfriend, who also suffered from Alzheimer's. Would that matter if he just fell in love with her but did not actually consummate the marriage physically? Would that be so bad? If he did consummate the marriage physically, would that really be adultery? Beyond that, I wondered about her. Surely going through a travail such as this would exhaust you emotionally, and you might end up feeling very lonely and in need of a new relationship. So I wondered, well, what about her needs? What if she were to fall in love again? What if she were to be so lucky as to find a boyfriend? You know, we don't always find love when we want it. But what if she did? What would we Americans say about her if she were to fall in love again while he was still alive? Would we want to call that adultery? Would that really be so bad? If adultery is as bad as we have been saying it is for thousands of years, then maybe what she could do is just divorce him, and then she could legally marry again, and she would be immersed in a moral relationship that we could all smile on and bless. But I thought, well, that doesn't sound right either. So I kept thinking and thinking, and beyond that, I thought, well, what if she were to fall in love again? What if she had a really nice boyfriend who understood her situation and agreed to live in this sort of moral limbo? He was having an affair with a woman who was technically married, but in a sense already widowed. Well, what would her obligations to this new boyfriend be? What if he said to her one day, I don't have enough money to send my son or daughter to college, which is very expensive. Could you, Sandra, float me $100,000 or so? Would she have an obligation to support him? I wondered about that, and then I also wondered about the possibility that she might want to perhaps just, if you will, play the field for a while. So maybe she would have two men in her life, or three, that she would date casually. What if one of the new boyfriends were to say to her, I demand that you give me an exclusive relationship. I know that you and I are not married. I know that you don't want to divorce Mr. O'Connor, but I want you to tell me that you will not date any other men. You have that obligation to me. So it seemed to me that Justice O'Connor was ushering in all sorts of moral questions to which I couldn't find answers. And I really, really wondered, what would it be like to walk in Justice O'Connor's shoes? And what I ended up in this book doing was arguing for something I call sexual generosity. What I ended up doing was saying that Justice O'Connor, or any of the millions of people in her shoes, should have the right to choose for themselves whether they want to remain monogamous, or whether they should decide, whether they should have the moral right to decide to start a new relationship before their actual legal marriage had ended.
I just find this so fascinating. Again, our guest today, Dr. John Portman, he's a professor at UVA in the Religious Studies Department. We're talking about his recently or upcoming, John, which is it? I know it was...
just out right now.
Just out, the paperback version, The Ethics of Sex and Alzheimer's. Let's do this, and then we'll be right back with our guest. And we'll take questions by phone a little later in the program if you're interested.
Support today for WNRN comes from the Jefferson Theater, presenting Shooter Jennings and Cody Purvis, Friday, July 12th. Shooter Jennings joins with local artist Cody Purvis for a show in Charlottesville. Tickets for the July 12th show are at jeffersontheater.com. Shooter Jennings and Cody Purvis, Friday, at the Jefferson Theater.
And support for WNRN today coming from T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing, an internationally recognized standard for production and consumption of forest products. T&N Printing can be reached at 434-971-8976 and t-nprinting.com. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks for tuning in. Again, this is WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. For the regular listeners, if you like WNRN and you listen to the Wake-Up Call on a regular basis, We're looking for a second producer for the show. Andy's getting ready to go to college. If you have interest in the program, you can volunteer 2 Sundays a month and you have a basic ability with computers. We can teach you the rest. Email me at rmoore@wnrn.org or stop by the station. Just let us know that you have an interest to volunteer here at WNRN. Back with our guest, Professor John Portman from UVA, talking about his recently released book, The Ethics of Sex and Alzheimer's. Dr. Portman, you were telling us, again, this sort of fascinating interest and how it all came about to get you to write the book. But there's a historical version of this as well. I mean, we're talking about Sandra Day O'Connor and sort of the what's happened in the past 20 years as Alzheimer's has increased, as you use the words epidemic. But tell me a little bit about the religious history in terms of this. Some of the notes that I picked out of the book, the religious definition of marriage, and how part of this was due to the fact that the return of Jesus was expected to be somewhat imminent. And so these definitions and rules of marriage and sex were based on a somewhat short-term outlook.
Yes, so I indicated how I grew fascinated by this topic, which initially sounded to some of my friends kind of weird and far out. And it occurred to me that some people might say about anyone married to Alzheimer's, or just for the sake of convenience, we might say Justice O'Connor, only because we know that she lived through this, as did Nancy Reagan. We might say, well, listen, you know, when you get married in a traditional Jewish or Christian ceremony, you pledge to stay together till death do us part. And you just have to, if you will, suck it up if something bad happens. So Justice O'Connor is married for many decades in a traditional Christian marriage, and one day she finds out that her husband doesn't know who she is anymore. No, she does not have a right to fall in love again. She must stay by his side faithfully until he should die, even if that should be decades from now. Well, that view is somewhat problematic, because if you look at what a Christian marriage means, technically, legally, you see that it comes down to sex. So I focused on 1 Corinthians 7. Paul of Tarsus was, of course, originally Saul. He was a Jew who hated Christians and who persecuted them. He underwent a famous conversion, which has been memorialized in various paintings, perhaps most memorably that of Caravaggio. So Saul is on horseback and there's this lightning in the sky. God knocks Saul out of his saddle. He falls onto the ground, and then God asks, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And Saul then becomes Paul, and he becomes, in many regards, the chief missionary of Christianity, this young sect. He takes upon himself to spread it, and it's possible that the sect would not have survived had he not worked so hard to ensure its longevity. So Saul takes something called the conjugal debt from Judaism and places it front and center in the new Christian sexual ethic. In 1 Corinthians 7, in 1 Corinthians, Paul does something very unusual, and he makes the world safe for celibates, for people who do not choose to marry, who swear off sex. In Judaism, as would later be the case in Islam, everyone has to get married. A person who says, "I don't want to get married," is very odd and arguably somewhat dangerous. Everyone gets married. Well, what Paul does is say, no, there are two classes of people. There are people who can live without sex, and they are the people we really admire. They're the sort of varsity bench, if you will. And then there are all the rest of us who cannot live without sex. And what are we going to do with them? Well, it's better that they marry one person and fulfill all of their lust with that one person than that they be having sex with everyone all over town. So Paul says, by all means, if you can live without sex, do it. And keep in mind, Paul, like the other early Christians, thinks that Jesus will be returning imminently, and so his understanding of what it meant to live without sex arguably differs from ours today, because although some people may believe that, some Christians may believe that Jesus is returning tomorrow, there are plenty of others who do not expect that. They're open to the possibility that it may happen, but they're not expecting it in the way that arguably Paul did. So Paul tells early Christians, you may not have sex before marriage, because sex is only for marriage, and once you do get married, you have to have sex. This is the conjugal debt. So when a woman marries a man, the woman becomes the owner of the man's body. When a man marries a woman, the man becomes the owner of the woman's body. Each owns the other's body, and Paul cautions the couple, you really should not deny one another, because if you do, then you run the risk that the man is going to run off and look for sex from a prostitute or from some other woman. So,
Well, quickly, again, our guest today, Dr. John Portman, UVA's Department of Religious Studies, talking about the ethics of sex and Alzheimer's. Denying your married partner sex, is denial not viewed as a choice? I mean, if you're denying someone, how much of that is a choice by one person in the partnership to say no versus someone with Alzheimer's who can't say yes?
Okay, good. Paul is very skeptical about the idea that a married couple can deny one another sex for more than about 6 months. Paul is very wary of this idea and thinks that it's going to lead to immorality. It's going to lead to adultery. Adultery is one of the three sins in Judaism that cannot be forgiven. It's also a truly major sin in Christianity and in Islam as well. So, back to Justice O'Connor. For what it's worth, she is quite committed Episcopalian. So she finds herself in this Christian marriage. She promised to give sex to her husband on her wedding day. Now, he's in an Alzheimer's ward. He's actually, subsequently died. He's died recently. What if he wants sex from her now? Does she have a duty to give him sex? It could be argued that because she is a Christian and she entered this Christian marriage, that she does have a duty to give him sex. We know, we have statistics that quite a few people who succumb to dementia become hypersexualized. They want sex from everyone they see. Well, does Justice O'Connor want to sort of provide this kind of sort of preventative therapeutic sex to make it less likely that Justice O'Connor may be pawing other people on the Alzheimer's ward for sex? Well, that's a really tough question, isn't it? And what would it feel like for Justice O'Connor to have sex with a stranger, with a man who didn't know who she was? It probably would not be very fulfilling for her, although she might be somewhat saintly in going through with it. So there's that. And then, apart from that, she also is entitled to sexual fulfillment. Again, she signed up for this on her wedding day, and the Christian understanding of marriage sort of, if you will, guarantees her sexual fulfillment. Well, if she can't get it from her husband, who's now a stranger to her in the sense he doesn't know who she is, well, then what becomes of her sexual needs. It's, I think, difficult just to say to someone who's married to Alzheimer's, well, you have to accept the fact that you will never have sex again until your spouse dies, and perhaps never ever have sex again if your spouse should outlive you. I found that very difficult as well. So all this is to say that it's in my opinion, very difficult to say to someone married to Alzheimer's, that's to say someone whose spouse is suffering from late stages of Alzheimer's, well, you just have to accept this. You'll never have sex again. If you are in a traditional Jewish or Christian marriage, in a sense, the sex was guaranteed you, and it's a big sacrifice. Again, my argument is that you should be allowed a choice. The community in which you find yourself may celebrate you if you say, I am going to remain faithful, I'm going to remain monogamous. But your community should also refrain from throwing stones at you should you decide to enter a new romantic relationship before your spouse dies.
11:27 on the Wake Up Call, talking about the newly released paperback version of The Ethics of Sex and Alzheimer's with author Dr. John Portman. He's at UVA's Religious Studies Department. We'll open up the phone lines for your questions. I certainly have plenty on my own, but we'd love to hear yours. 434-979-0919. That's 434-979-0919. Now that we have the computer monitor in front of us, I can also take the instant message, WNRN Studio, on the AOL site, instant message. Dr. Portman, so what I heard a lot of is there's the version of selflessness, which is understanding the rules in one way, which is, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other part of the historical version, which says you use the phrase conjugal debt, which is we're married and you, by these rules, are required to provide me with satisfactory sex. Mm-hmm. So what sort of feedback do you get from strong faith religious believers? Because you can't pick both sides of that.
Right. Well, this is new terrain, and
sexual generosity, which we'll get into a little bit later.
Right. The research for my book was largely completed, and I was in the process of going through revisions for publication when a very interesting story involving Pat Robertson grabbed the headlines in the United States. So this was about 2 years ago. And Pat Robertson, hardly a liberal, was hosting his live 700 Club one day, and a caller got through and said to him, please help me. Please provide some guidance here. I am at my wit's end. My wife has suffered from Alzheimer's for several years now, and I don't know what to do. I cannot cope with this any longer. Mentally and physically, I am becoming unraveled. Please help me. Tell me what I should do. And Pat Robertson responded very confidently, well, you should dump her. Get a divorce. Move on with your life. Fall in love with someone new. Start over. That's the path forward for you.
And you use the word desertion.
Yes.
In your book.
Yes. Yes. So this was quite surprising, and a number of the media outlets noticed this and started talking about it. The following day, Pat Robertson was besieged by angry callers, other very conservative evangelical Christians, called him and lambasted him and said, this is sinful. Absolutely not. Under no circumstances should this man be encouraged to desert or divorce his wife. He should remain by her faithfully until she dies. And then to my surprise, and I confess to my disappointment, Pat Robertson said on air nationally, I made a mistake. I gave him the wrong advice. Anyone married to Alzheimer's should, in fact, hang in there forever and forego their own emotional, sexual needs and should selflessly recommit themselves to this marriage. So I think in answer to your question, Rick, that this shows us that Americans are very divided. For some Americans, particularly social conservatives, particularly those on the right, adultery is simply and utterly unacceptable. It never can or will be. And the idea that someone married to Alzheimer's should be allowed to go out and fall in love again simply cannot be entertained. That said, I am very interested in what I know to be true. Here in Charlottesville, here in affluent places such as Fairfield County, Connecticut, Westchester County, New York, Los Angeles County, California, Marin County, California, lots and lots of people who are married to Alzheimer's already are beginning new relationships on the side, and their friends and neighbors know that, and we don't really have a way of responding to these new relationships. I think that desertion is worse than falling in love again before your spouse dies. I talked about the conjugal debt and how very important it was and still is in Christian thought. But in the course of my research, I uncovered fascinating exceptions. In the medieval church, for example, when divorce was simply impossible, you couldn't get divorced. It was a matter of till death do us part. If your husband was, say, for example, a traveling salesman, he might go away trying to sell his wares and not come back for months and months at a time, maybe years at a time. At what point could you safely and legally assume your husband was never coming back? This was a real problem for the early church. And instead of saying to deserted spouses, if you will, deserted women, you got to hang in there forever, they did say after a certain point, you may assume that he's never coming back and you may remarry. We will dissolve the marriage and you may remarry. If your husband came back from war and he was disabled, perhaps he was paralyzed, perhaps he was not paralyzed, but he became impotent. He could no longer achieve an erection. The church recognized these cases as legitimate reasons for divorcing a spouse, and a woman was allowed to remarry and start a new life. So I discovered in the course of my research that having sex, being able to have sex, was considered so important that good Christians were allowed to divorce and move on. And what we see is that desertion was considered so awful that a divorce was sort of justified. And so in my book, what I argue for is this idea that desertion sends a really negative message to a community. We know that in Judaism and Christianity, a wedding is a very, very public affair. Think of all the controversy over gay marriage in America today. We care about gay marriage because marriage is so public. What we do as a community is bless this union. We say, yes, these two people now are married. And if someone deserts his or her spouse, we say, no, that's troubling. There's something very wrong here because we witnessed your marriage and we said the two of you will stay together, you know, forever. What I argue for, and of course, some people will disagree with me, is that it's better to sort of honor that original marriage commitment by remaining married to someone who's on an Alzheimer's ward, visiting that spouse occasionally, as often as you can, but beginning a new relationship on the side, falling in love and starting a new relationship on the side, which is not exactly a marriage. You can't do that because it's illegal in our country to be married to two people at the same time, but honors the spirit of that original commitment. What I believe is that things in America have changed quite significantly, such that we should no longer consider sexual fidelity the be-all and end-all, the touchstone of a marriage. There are other ways of showing fidelity, and one of them is to continue to visit your spouse on an Alzheimer's ward regularly while going on with your own life. I think that that's very important. I think that the baby boomers in America today are teaching us all something extremely important. Not so long ago, in the 1950s and the 1960s, the idea that an unmarried woman would have sex was scandalous. It was dangerous. Women like that really frightened us. And if they became pregnant before they married, we excoriated them. We ostracized them. We now know that many, many, many women in college, unmarried, are having sex. And although some of us may not like it, some people on the right may say, that's immoral, that's wrong, we're no longer shocked by this. And I think that baby boomers now, those in their 60s and their 70s, they are confronting a new kind of social prejudice, and they're changing that as well. They're showing us that you can honor a marriage in more ways than one. They're showing us that when someone married to Alzheimer's has to make a decision, am I going to sacrifice all of my romantic and sexual needs for the next couple of decades, or am I going to start over again while married, that we see a new kind of marital commitment, one that honors both the original vow, till death do us part, and that also honors the needs of a very healthy person who doesn't want to give up on life, at least in the romantic and sexual way, yet.
11:38 here on WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, talking about morals, ethics, sex, Alzheimer's, with Dr. John Portman from UVA, and his new book, Ethics of Sex and Alzheimer's.
Support for WNRN today comes from Pocahontas Live, presenting Creedence Clearwater Revisited Thursday, June 13th. Gates at 5, show at 6:30. Tickets for the Doobie Brothers with Laura Johnston on July 21st are on sale. There's music all summer at Pocahontas State Park in Chesterfield. Tickets at PocahontasLive.com. WNRN is supported by Ragged Mountain Running Shop, number 3 Elliewood Avenue on the UVA corner. Ragged Mountain specializes in hard-to-fit feet, injury resolution, and training advice, and features nearly a dozen brands of running shoes. Charlottesville's community running headquarters since 1982, the Ragged Mountain Running Shop.
The Center for Human-Animal Interaction in Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine was established in 2001. Hi, I'm Dr. Sandra Barker, and this is the first center of its kind to be established in a school of medicine in the nation. CHI's most visible program is our Dogs on Call, our animal-assisted therapy and pet visitation program in the VCU Medical Center. CHI brings therapy dogs and their wonderful volunteer owners from the community to visit patients and staff throughout the medical center, and we research the benefits of human animal interaction. The Center for Human-Animal Interaction offers educational opportunities for medical and other students, and the center activities are made possible primarily through donations and with assistance from many talented volunteers. Visit our center website at chai.vcu.edu for more information.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection@wnrn.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks for being with us today, talking about the ethics of sex and Alzheimer's, the recently released paperback version from Dr. John Portman. He's a professor of religious studies over at UVA. Dr. Portman, I can't remember exactly what triggered the thought, but there have been changes, at least in one place, made with new policies. And it was in part of your book, The Hebrew Home for the Aged. Policies. Tell us about that.
Right, right. So in New York City, I found this very interesting Home for the Aged, the Hebrew Home for the Aged, which grabbed my attention because of their very liberal policy regarding sexual activity. We are aware that more and more and more Americans are ending up in what we've long referred to as old age homes. And we are aware that many people living there want to be sexually active. Some people are demented, some people are not, some people are beginning a long slide down the path to dementia. What we hear from caregivers is that much of the difficulty surrounding the interpretation of the sexual activity comes from children whose parents are in these homes. Many children dislike very much the idea that their parents would be sexually active in one of these homes. If a man is a widower and he meets a woman who's a widow in a home, or perhaps the woman is married to someone with Alzheimer's, there are all sorts of permutations of possibilities here. A romance could blossom and a sexual relationship as well. And we have evidence and statistics that many children in their 40s and 50s dislike intensely the idea that their parents could be involved in such a relationship for a variety of reasons.
Quick question, though. These policies, or at least for this one, so back up. Are there? Did you find more than one
yes.
home?
Yeah.
So,
well, of the conservative sort, yes.
Okay.
Most homes say no sexual activity because they don't want to be sued.
But if I remember the reading properly, is that the policies do not allow anyone who has dementia. So if you have Alzheimer's, someone who is suffering from Alzheimer's, despite the fact that Alzheimer's does not destroy or remove sexual urges, that person's, we're not providing them with any rules or regulations that allow for that.
Right.
Like Sandra Day O'Connor said, okay, you know, my husband, who it does have an issue here, yes, the person that you have found, who also has some form of dementia, you can get together. But the Hebrew Home for the Aged, they wouldn't fall under the okay form of that policy, correct?
No, just the opposite. So older citizens become, in a sense, like teenagers. I mean, you have to watch them night and day because given 10 minutes, they could slip away and get up to who knows what. So they must be constantly watched and perhaps segregated by sex. The Hebrew Home for the Aged views sexual expression as an integral part of human flourishing. And their policy is that if you are going to bring your mother or father here, your family member here, you must accept that we not only allow it, but we bless the sexual expression of the older people living in our home because we think this is going to make their remaining lives richer and more fulfilling. And so their approach to sexual expression of any older person, including perhaps that of someone suffering from dementia, is a very positive one. And what I try to do in the book is praise that approach and defend it because they fly in the face of this idea that marriage requires selflessness. When we get married, we have to make any number of sacrifices. We have to forget about our selfish needs and we have to surrender ourselves to the marriage vow that we took. And we must, if we find ourselves married to someone with Alzheimer's, we must sort of forget about our needs. We must move beyond them and simply live this sort of, if you will, sort of saintly model existence. No, in the Hebrew Home for the Aged, we see a wonderful counterexample of this, saying that no, actually, sexual surrender, sexual sacrifice is not necessary.
Again, Dr. John Portman here with us as we talk about the ethics of sex and Alzheimer's. Dr. Portman, one of the bases in terms of for history of how we've gotten to the point of selflessness and accepting our situation. You talk about Queen Victoria sort of setting the standard for this.
Yes. So as I thought of Justice O'Connor again and all those many people married to Alzheimer's, I saw a clear parallel with widowhood. My own mother has just very recently died, and now my father is a widower, and this has come as a shock in ways that are not entirely predictable. I started looking at what it feels like to be a literal widow or widower. Someone who is married to Alzheimer's is not literally widowed because their spouse is still technically alive, even though the spouse may not recognize them anymore. I looked at public figures because it's very difficult to gauge popular opinion, but we can see in our sort of role models or political leaders clues about what is assumed to be correct, morally acceptable behavior. And so I looked at Queen Victoria, surely one of the most powerful women of the 19th century. This English monarch was famously in love with Prince Albert. She bore him many, many, many children, and then he died at a fairly young age. And she spent the rest of her long life in this sort of, if you will, flamboyant mourning. I don't mean that at all disrespectfully, but she always wore black. She always talked about him. She was always sad. She was always mourning him. She was always crying. And whether she meant to or not, she set the pace for women in the UK and arguably in America as well. She sent the signal that when your husband dies, you should go on mourning forever. I looked back in 1 Corinthians and saw that St. Paul recommended just this kind of behavior. Interestingly enough, St. Paul said, women, if your husband should die, you should not think of marrying again. You should just remain in that state unless the woman should be young, say in her 20s. And St. Paul says, if the woman is widowed at a young age, then she really should remarry because she risks becoming the town busybody. I found that very interesting. But older women, say women in their 30s, end up really should not think about trying to find a new husband. They should just remain as they are.
Now, again, at the time, women in their 30s were
old.
Right, 75% of the way through life.
Right. But then I looked at someone like Nancy Reagan. So Nancy Reagan may not be quite so beloved as Justice O'Connor. Justice O'Connor is that rare individual who's loved by both the right and the left in America. So Nancy Reagan, clearly, a social conservative. Nonetheless, I think really does have the respect of the left. I mean, it doesn't really matter. She's an instantly recognized public figure in America, a very, very powerful woman, very Christian woman. And we know that Nancy Reagan must have suffered quite a lot. She as well was married to Alzheimer's for a number of years before President Reagan died. And I scoured her writings, her public appearances. I don't know what sort of private life she led, but publicly, Nancy Reagan has clearly been a single woman. She's been a woman who has not dated, who has not remarried. And what I worry about is that women today face tremendous pressure to sacrifice their romantic and sexual needs when they become literal widows, but also when they find themselves married to Alzheimer's. I think that women in the United States are much, much more vulnerable to criticism and ostracism than men.
All right. Again, our guest, Dr. John Portman, we're talking about the ethics of sex and Alzheimer's. And let me find the right button. Star, are you with me?
Yes, sir, I am.
A question or a comment for Dr. Portman?
Well, I just had some comments. I certainly have enjoyed listening to the program this morning, and it is quite intriguing, I will say that. I just would like to comment that I feel like, you know, as a follower of Christ and the Lord making the ultimate sacrifice for us, and I think that marriage is a picture of our relationship with the Lord. I do believe that as far as the sexual relationship, it is important. At the same time, I think that, you know, there might be situations in marriage that, you know, we can't always get what we want, and, you know, we can certainly go through trials, but I think that, you know, we've been promised in the Word that the Lord will not tempt us above what we are able, and that He will, you know, honor us to try to stay faithful to our spouses. So I think that ultimately each person does have to make their own choice, as in every day we make choices that we do the thing that we feel like is the right thing or honorable to the Lord, and that ultimately we have to give an account of ourselves to the Lord. So with that being said, I don't know if Dr. Portman has any more comments or thoughts about that, but I know I feel that it is painful for people like, you know, Sandra Day O'Connor, I'm sure. You know, and it's, I think it's good that he's thought about all these things, and I appreciate his expertise. And thank you so much.
Hey, Star, hang on for just a second. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
So in the case of Sandra Day O'Connor, can I ask you, who committed the sin? Did Sandra Day O'Connor commit the sin by allowing her husband, or did he commit the sin by doing so when he didn't understand and didn't have the mental abilities to realize that he was already married?
Right. Yeah. Well, personally, with, you know, just being faced with that question, my first thought is this. I think that her husband, bless his heart, was obviously unable to know that she was his, you know, lawful wife. I know that I believe God looks on the heart individually. I don't think that, you know, personally, I don't think that God's going to judge Sandra Day O'Connor's husband harshly, because we live in a fallen world, and we have disease, we have Alzheimer's, we have a bunch of other things that we cannot help. The poor man cannot help it. Sandra Day O'Connor, what a lady. You know, I don't even know how to say anything. I mean, I can't even imagine being in her shoes. And I think she's just showing her husband grace. And, again, I don't think anybody committed a sin. And I'm not the judge, but I just think, wow.
All right. Well, thanks.
I'm not saying I think that what she did was wrong or right. I just think that it showed a lot of grace on her part to understand that her husband is no longer maybe able to make that decision. And, you know, what good would it do for her to scream at him and fuss at him and say, you know, you're wrong, you're a sinner, you're bad, you know, you're whatever. She loves him. She's showing extreme, ultimate selflessness as far as I'm concerned.
All right, Star. Thank you so much for the call and the conversation.
Thank you.
All right. Our guest today, Professor John Portman from UVA's Department of Religious Studies.
WNRN is supported by Price Hyundai on 29 North. From Hyundai, it's the new Sonata Hybrid, 38 miles per gallon highway, and breakthrough lithium polymer technology. Also the 38 miles per gallon highway Elantra. You can find out more at jimpricehyundai.com.
Support today for WNRN comes from Waynesboro Parks and Recreation, presenting the 34th annual Summer Extravaganza celebration at Ridgeview Park on Saturday. There will be a 5 and 10K race starting at 8 a.m., fireworks in the evening, and family fun in between. For more information, waynesboro.va.us and 540-942-6735.
All right, back with our guest, Dr. John Portman, as we talk about his book, The Ethics of Sex and Alzheimer's. Dr. Portman, just a few minutes left. It is 11:55. Les Temps Perdue up next. So sexual generosity is a big part of the book. You've identified that it's sort of a phrase and almost a behavior that you have both invented the phrase and proclaimed a behavior that we should be more thoughtful and accepting of.
Yes. Yes.
But how do you determine, I mean, if you tell someone like Star or anyone else who's listening, is sexual generosity, do we have acceptable sins versus sins that, I'm sorry, it is a sin and you've, I think, just to paraphrase her, you signed up to be married and you accept what God gives you.
Yes. Good question. So our notion of what is morally acceptable and not changes over time. So I've talked about the conjugal debt. I've talked about sexual ownership. This is an idea that makes many Americans uncomfortable today, the idea that a wife owns her husband's body or that a husband owns his wife's body. Despite the fact that we remain ostensibly an extremely Christian nation, we have rebelled against at least one aspect of St. Paul's teaching. In the 1980s, a number of women, feminist thinkers, worked very, very hard to establish a new kind of sin, a new kind of crime, and that is marital rape. It used to be that the idea of a wife suing her husband or bringing him to court for raping her just didn't make any sense, because if he was your husband, he couldn't rape you. He's your husband. And we no longer think that way. This is now in each of the 50 states a crime. The mere fact that you have a wife does not mean that you can force yourself on her sexually. If she does not want to have sex with you, she can say no. Now, in defense of St. Paul, he also says you don't have to provide sex every single time you're asked for it, but pretty much most of the time. And in any event, we see now that there's a new kind of sin, if you will, certainly a new kind of crime, and that's marital rape. I think that because people are living so long now, and there are many different kinds of diseases, Alzheimer's is not the only one, but for the sake of sort of simplicity, I focus on in the book. I think that it makes real sense for young people or older people contemplating marriage today to talk about this. In the 1980s, it was awkward for a wealthy person who was marrying someone who wasn't wealthy to say, look, I want a prenup. If in the event we should divorce, you ask for more than $5 million, I'm going to say no and my lawyers are going to come in. But now that's centered popular consciousness.
Let me ask you a quick question. So we're talking about sexual generosity, mm-hmm. in the sense of someone with Alzheimer's, someone who has a fatal disease, even if fatal qualifies as long term, not a year like some cancers, et cetera. What happens? Can you put sexual generosity on someone much younger? Can a teenager who has a fatal cancer, can you say, yes, let's provide sex or allow sex to this person? How do you cross, or where do you draw the line?
Well, it's very, very difficult for people contemplating marriage to talk about divorce, because, of course, you want to think your marriage is going to last forever. But whether you're 22 or 42, it makes sense to say to the person you're marrying, look, what do you want? In the event that I should succumb to something like Alzheimer's, do you want to remain faithful to me forever? Or do you think it's possible that you might fall in love again? Of course, it's going to be extremely difficult to say, oh, I might want to fall in love again. But I think it deserves moral praise when someone says, in the event that I should succumb to Alzheimer's, I want you to fall in love again. I don't want you to wait for me to die. Alzheimer's doesn't just happen overnight. It goes through stages. And when someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, so while someone's still, say, for example, in stage one Alzheimer's, he or she could say to the spouse, look, I give you permission. Right. This is going to be extremely difficult for you. And I don't want you to say no in the lucky event, the fortunate event, that love should come knocking on your door. Maybe okay. You will meet someone.
We're going to have to finish up.
I want you to avail yourself of this possibility, and I want you to fall in love before I die. I see that as sexual generosity.
All right. Dr. Portman, thank you so much. Again, there's so much
more
to keep talking about this with Dr. John Portman from UVA's Department of Religious Studies, current paperback book, The Ethics of Sex and Alzheimer's. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, Les Timms-Perdue up next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Angie Cruz. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.